Hi, I'm Jonathan Mann.
I'm one of the many Matts.
And this is Digitally Rare, a show about digitally owned things now and Coke Zero Day.
Yeah, are we going to play that before or after? If we play it after,
it'll
listener,
be after, yeah.
Yeah, tune in to the end to get that reference. Welcome to the pod, Tor, co-founder of Stash. It's delightful to have you.
Thanks for having me on, man. This is going to be a lot of fun, I can tell.
Stash with two H's.
Yes. Stash. Well, yeah. Stash, which is such a clever name, right?
That's nice. Oh, I like that.
That's one of the things that struck me is Stash. Because,
Appreciate that.
The context is Stash is a social network that it's a lot of things, but it understands digital ownership. And that's like the part that I'm particularly interested in. We've talked about this a lot on the pod before is like digital things need a context in which they can be meaningful and that context need also be social and so on and so forth. And Stash is definitely in that domain. And so wanted to chat with you about Stash more generally and also that. And the reason Stash is named Stash is because it's related to the Secret Network.
Yeah, we started very much focused on a single L1 ecosystem, which was the Secret ecosystem, mostly because all those things that you mentioned, digital ownership, having a social context, all these things, I see the link between all of that and things like privacy, which are kind of nebulous as concepts, but inextricable from those ideas, like social as a term just kind of means sharing, but usually there's a context for that sharing with whom, under what circumstances and what conditions. Privacy works the same way. In the blockchain space, we have a weird understanding of privacy because we, by default, make everything public. But in the real world and in the social world, that's not the case. By default, we don't share something. We have to choose to go on Facebook and post about it. We choose to go on Twitter and yell at somebody. You know, these are choices that we make. So Stash acknowledges there's this link between digital ownership and privacy and social and all this other stuff. It ends up in the name for sure, but also in the product.
Totally. Yeah.
I don't know anything about Secret. Can we just detour very quickly to say what Secret the L1 is? I guess based on privacy, what you know,
how told you it wouldn't be a secret.
I know. I'm just kidding. It seems so unfair.
Where does it slot into like the history of privacy chains? Like what's the thing?
So the way that we describe it is like you've got Bitcoin, the OG, you know, you have this chain and it's got this native coin for value, right? This is the intention. It does transactions, it doesn't do computations, and it doesn't do privacy, but it's the OG, it's the thing, it's the most valuable, highest security chain. Then you have these two separate evolutionary streams. One goes off into smart contract land, like Ethereum, and it's focused on programmability. And what if these were just sort of self-executable code blocks, right, sitting on a chain? And then on the other hand, you have chains like Monero and Zcashes of the world that are saying, what if we took those transactions, but we had privacy by default? And then maybe these concepts like auditability or shareability, but you switch the default from radically transparent to private by default, which is something even Satoshi wrote about being, if not necessary, at least strongly advisable for the sustainability of some kind of decentralized currency. And Secret took those two evolutionary streams and slammed them back together. Hmm. So that became a network where you had programmability, but also privacy. And smart contracts on Secret were the first smart contracts to have this ability to use encrypted inputs and encrypted outputs to have encrypted state. And it opened up this crazy design space. The mainnet went live in 2020, right? This is not bleeding edge, totally new tech. It's been live. It's been battle tested in production. It's also been really battle tested in production. We've had people try to crack the entire network, leak the decryption seeds, you know, like it's gotten a lot of attention.
Cool.
But that's what you get for shipping, right? That's kind of the trade-off. If you want to have something worth using, it's also going to be worth attacking. And so the community and the tech and everything else is battle-hardened by this stage. And that foundation gave us the confidence to say, okay, with Stash, we're going to try to build something very user-friendly or user-focused using that core technology. I always try to get to the point. And the point for me is always, is somebody using it? I don't care what your L1 is or does. If there's nobody at the end of the day who decides mm-hmm. to use it, the mm-hmm. tech that wins is the tech that gets used. Always. Totally. It doesn't matter if it's the most bulletproof technology. It always happens to be what's the tech that gets into people's hands. Stash wants tech in people's hands, but it also wants to solve the right problems. And a lot of the problems we saw going unsolved had less to do with permissionless, decentralized, leveraged finance, much more to do with digital ownership. Mm-hmm. So that's how we got from here to there. We had the L1. We said, what can we do with this core privacy tech? Digital ownership makes a lot of sense. Let's build Stash on top of that. And then, of course, the platform has evolved a lot since then.
Cool. And so obviously this results in NFTs with some sort of secret attachment data. That, how does that like verification work?
So a secret NFT, you know, any NFT is just a contract on a chain, but every contract on secret is encrypted. So if you create
the actual
something
code,
well, the code of the contract is public and auditable, but the data, right? The inputs, the outputs, and the data, state of the contract, you need a decryption key in order to read. So if you are a user, if you're a wallet owner, you can generate a viewing key or a query permit to be able to decrypt the state of the contract that you're supposed to have access to. So for an NFT, if you're the owner, you can decrypt the private metadata field that you're supposed to have access to. Or you can create a field of the NFT that's permanently unwrappable, but only by the owner. So even the owner can't see it, but once they unwrap it, it's public to everybody. That degree of programmability was the design space for NFTs that got us super excited. And that's what secret NFTs give you. So originally, Stash, there was enough to build as a platform just focused on encrypted NFTs. That design space had never been explored. But then we realized everyone is so used to the alternative. Everyone on every other blockchain is so used to public by default NFTs because that's how they work on ETH, Polygon, Solana, Tezos. They're all the same. By the time we got to teach people the power of encrypted NFTs, they were off buying the next drop. What powered NFT adoption was not really just how cool is the tech. It was really like how cool is the culture. And so Stash made this evolutionary jump, right? We couldn't just have the coolest tech. We couldn't just expand the design space. We knew there had to be that social context you're describing. And that's going to make this new tech that much more valuable. Not only will you do groundbreaking revolutionary stuff with encrypted NFTs, but you'll finally do it in a context that gives these things not only immediate meaning, but long-term value.
Totally. Yeah. I think the context is, I mean, it's paramount to meaning. Without Twitter, I think the larger NFT art experience would not exist.
It wouldn't exist. Yeah. It wouldn't have. It was like the primary place for it.
Totally.
And it's dying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's real. It's fracturing in real time. And we're literally seeing the, you know, the, what is that, aggregation theory, expand, contract, like it's all happening in real time.
Yeah. Which is we see the same trend. We see the same trend. Well, it's exciting for us because Twitter is what we're trying to disrupt. We don't want to put OpenSea or Magic Eden out of business. You know, they're incredible marketplaces and they serve exactly the need that artists and collectors needed in this space. And that didn't exist really until the last couple of years when it came to maturity. But Twitter is this rusty, broken, megalomaniac. You know I'm not going to be able to say this word. I'm
just maniacal.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just going to say Elon's toy. Why in this decentralized permissionless space, why are we handing over the keys to Elon? I do think, and we'll probably get into it, we're not ready to decentralize all the things. But when you've got somebody kind of setting direction top down at that stage for a product, and we're all relying on it as creators and collectors, and there's almost an open hostility toward those communities on most traditional social, we've really potentially compromised ourselves. And Stash is trying to take back and walk that balance, right? Between centralization, decentralization, being functional and being anarchy. How do we walk that line in a way that benefits creators and collectors more than the traditional world and more than the rest of the Web3 world has been able to achieve to date?
Totally. Yeah. It's about having confidence in the substrate.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, just having software that understands digital ownership is just the obvious next step. All of the crypto stuff that we've shoehorned into Twitter has been like not only against the owner of Twitter's desires, perhaps, but like the software itself, like if you were to humanize it, it doesn't want like this. It doesn't really link to NFTs. Like none of it really works. And so software that natively understands digital ownership, I think is really, really exciting.
Definitely.
And that's, it's social networks. It's like the computer itself. It's, you know, phones. Like when are we going to get like a native hardware, not hardware wallet, but like secure
element wallet? You don't have a Solana phone?
Yeah, so I was going to say totally. Solana phone.
No, this is like the next obvious step. And so like, I find all of that really exciting.
For sure.
That's tight. So Stash has a bunch of different things going on, one of which is the social context. The other which that I got really excited about was the gumball machines.
Yeah.
That's something that I've always enjoyed the IRL experience of. And I was surprised that we haven't really full sent into the online equivalent of that just yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, can you tell us more about the gumball machines and how y'all like approach that?
Yeah, gumball machines is just, again, we're not trying to create new human behaviors. Mm. The way that I've always understood social is that the most successful social products just try to emulate and amplify deeply human behaviors. And one of which is, you know, like going back to caveman times and scrounging for berries and you finally find one and it's not poisonous. And like that feeling of excitement, that rush of dopamine. Why is it so hard to like replicate that in so many social experiences online? Usually it's the opposite, right? Like you're on Twitter until you find the really angry berry and then you're pissed off the rest of the day. Nobody wants that. So gumball machines is expanding this idea of digital ownership and trying to create a positive emotional experience on platform. You go, somebody's created a collection. You import whatever many assets you want to be in that collection. They sit in this giant gumball machine. When a user comes and mints from that gumball machine, something pops out, one of the things it's been loaded with. It could be the really rare thing. It could be the pretty normal thing. But the nice thing about the gumball machines on Stash is that these assets can have public traits, private traits, wrappable traits, unwrappable traits. So that's a much more expanded version of that like initial mint experience. Not only can you mint the thing, then you can unwrap the thing. And it's like, so you first get that impression of like, oh, here's what's on the outside. Then you open it up. And here's what's on the inside. It's that depth of experience, that two-tiered experience of unwrapping and exploring and discovering. That's what we want every experience on Stash to feel like because we know how fun it can be.
That's
and
really
we do,
fun.
And we let any artist do that with no code, right? You don't have to code your own off-platform mint experience and hope it doesn't break on the day. You just come, everybody rushes in. You can also gate them the same way you can gate any other mint. Oh, this gumball machine is only for my Twitter followers. This gumball machine is only if you own from my collection on ETH. This gumball, you know, and just sort of arbitrarily limit it to the, exactly the people you want to be able to have that experience. And Stash helps mediate that for you. But a lot of that, especially with the collection gated stuff, a lot of that is still Web3. It's expanding our new concept of digital ownership into access to new experiences. And we want those experiences to be on Stash because that's where we know we can provide this depth of experience. And also we think there's long-term value to not only the assets that you're getting, but your social reputation.
Yeah.
I'm noticing that the gumballs are priced in dollars, in fiat, which is like, you know, which is a, you know, from an NFT collector point of view is not unheard of certainly, but like relatively unusual, right?
Yeah, the reason for that is because we've gone so multi-chain, right? I told you Stash started out very focused on the Secret ecosystem. Like all the marketplace features are still just around Secret as an L1. We're not expanding and trying to do a marketplace for Optimism, a marketplace for Tezos, a marketplace for all these things. Those chains already have marketplaces that
and
serve
OpenSea
most
is the aggregate. OpenSea aggregates.
Effective job of it, right? We're not trying to be that. We're trying to get that social context around digital collectability, and then also with encrypted NFTs, that's something that's not offered anywhere else. Doesn't matter what marketplace, no one is doing it. You put those together, something more sustainable. But because we have this multi-chain support for these, and we'll get into social profiles and things like that. But because we support collectors from any chain, they might not be used to landing on a gumball machine or something in the marketplace and seeing something priced out in Tezos, seeing something priced out in Secret. Maybe they're only used to ETH, or maybe they're not. Maybe they're only used to seeing something priced out in Sol. And then they come to a platform and they see something in a totally different currency. It's our best effort to put something in terms that not only an experienced NFT collector, but a new NFT collector would understand. And then you can decide for yourself, like, is this worth that to me? We could also have settings on the platform where it's like convert everything to ETH using some public API or Chainlink or whatever. It's like you can just figure out what that means to you. But that was our best attempt at the universality of things. We're not really expecting people to put in a credit card. We kind of understand that if the assets are digitally native, probably the currency you're using to acquire them is also digitally native. But we also don't want to close that door or overwhelm the user or make it feel like Stash is full of gates and we hold all the keys and you'll walk through when you say you can. It's like not the emotional experience we want to give a new user.
And then I also noticed that to connect, it's you have many different ways to connect from Ethereum to Discord, Google, Kepler and Finna, which I assume are secret wallets. Mm-hmm.
Yep, they are.
Is the account that when it's created, is it an NFT that I, or is it a sort of a digital object that I own, my account?
This is a really great question. And it's probably the thing we discuss the most actively internally is how we should arbitrate this idea of identity. Because we have a little bit of technical debt here. It may be good technical debt, but we should talk about it. We started the platform as only focused on Secret as a blockchain. And really the unit of account for Stash is a secret address. If you have a secret address, you have an account on Stash. But we don't like that model for the long term of being a multi-chain social marketplace. Even if Secret is a first-class citizen in the marketplace and in every feature on the platform, that's not where we need to go to. So what we're doing, and this requires some refactoring, is we're trying to figure out what is an open protocol that we can rely on for universal identity. And right now, our best effort is email, because that is an open universal protocol. So we're moving all of these user accounts to be like, okay, the unit of account, at least as Stash understands you, is you have an email login. However, what we're doing once you have your email there to establish the account is connect as many wallets from as many blockchains as you want. Connect as many Web2 identities to this thing as you want. All you're saying is I have this universal profile on Stash. It includes my Twitter identity. It includes my Google identity. It includes this, 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 this. Not because we want to control your identities, but we need to be able to read those identities to synthesize them and present them to other users on the platform.
Right.
That's the value that we give. In the long run, what that allows us to do is issue an identity NFT on whatever chain we want, to whatever user we want. Then there's issues with, you know, should that be soulbound? How, you know, should it be private by default as opposed to public by default? And like you reveal aspects of your identity NFT depending on who is the inquirer. Should they have read access to that portion of your identity and social reputation? We can decentralize all the things over time. But as those are unsolved problems, and if we try to decentralize it fast and they're not solved up front, it can break a lot of the user experience to do that wrong. And so it's like a little further down the pipeline as opposed to just like, let's at least move to an open protocol like email as the core unit of account. Then let's figure out how to move identity on chain in a way where we also think privacy can be respected.
There's also like DIDs, decentralized identifiers. Have you looked much into that? That we got very excited about those.
Yeah, the issue with those, so the last, I should give some historical context on me personally. The last 6 years of my life, I've been leading growth for the Secret ecosystem, and DIDs have come up every single moment since 2017. Talking, and this is the thing, is like, are these universal standards? Like, how do these standards kind of emerge? Who's actually going to leverage these standards in the hands of users? Like, what does a user conceive of as a universal identifier? Is it their email? Is it their Apple ID? Like, how do they think about it? From an advertiser's point of view, they understand your identity to be exactly that, like your ad ID, like what you've looked at across every single platform. What universally we understand about you as a consumer, is that how we want our identities to be perceived? So this question of decentralized identity is probably the hardest question in the space. We come at it, I guess this is something I have a personally pessimistic point of view on, because everyone in the space, the Web3 space, is so obsessed with these radically transparent storage systems. And I think that those are the absolute wrong foundation to build decentralized identity systems on. And I've had conversations about this with like Vitalik and Glenn Weil and people like that who've thought a lot about these issues. It's unsolved. I don't think we're the ones who are going to like begin by solving it, but I do know that anything that relies on that like radically transparent foundation is not something we want to build our whole foundation on. But as soon as there's something that protects privacy, that is universally interoperable and composable, we'll be the first ones to integrate it. I just don't think we'll be the first ones to invent it.
Yeah, it seems to be one of those catch-22 problems where there's no universal identity standard, but then every platform like wants one, and so on and so forth. And
it's that, yeah. I said this about all of the, someone was tweeting like, oh, I wish that there was a protocol that like Farcaster and Lens and Blue Sky yes. could all use. But then it's like that XKCD cartoon of totally. Like,
that's there come up be, on so many podcasts.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's it. That's the, no, 100%. That's the thing.
It's, there are yeah. now 15 competing standards.
Right. Exactly. That's the,
yeah. No, yeah. I wonder how adoption of something like that occurs. Obviously it's a
socially
chicken and egg. Yeah.
Socially. But, you build a massive social network that's
well,
sort
it's
of
almost
Web3
like you
native.
Were saying, email is yeah. sort of it. Fortunately or unfortunately, it's like our decentralized identities are email. It's our email. Like yeah. that's consensus.
And you could do a lot worse because email has things like social recovery, you know, depending on the platform. There's also a little bit of trust, but you can self-host an email. But then the issue becomes around like spam and deliverability and yeah. all these other yeah. Much right. older questions of communication.
Older questions.
It's like if you
yeah.
have too much communication because there's no cost to communication. How do you preserve the meaning of a communication?
Right.
You know,
right.
without any cost to the communication, is there any value to the communication? And the blockchain starts to sort of enforce some of that. So again, old questions, the extent to which Stash builds our product is, you know, we mostly just spend all day thinking about what problems do we want to solve. We're aware of many hundreds of problems. So let's look at the big board of problems. Let's pick the five that we think Stash is in the best position to solve before anybody else. And let's teach more users than everybody and hope they all show up and stay. I feel like that's all we can do without driving ourselves absolutely insane.
So before we get to the core product, the other fun thing that I'm looking at here is this community canvas. Can you tell us about what the community canvas is?
Community canvas is a product. We've seen some people experiment with this in like in other ecosystems, but as a community member, you can go and spend gems, which are like an on-platform currency, not on chain, but on platform. Mm. You spend gems and you can pay to overwrite one of the squares on this canvas. It's a 5x5 canvas. Each square is its own art. So what the community will do is these sub-communities will fight and they'll repaint the canvas
right.
from day to day to day to try to take it over because the community canvas is something we promote on the main page. So it sort of gamifies this interaction with gems.
Oh, that's fun. Yeah.
But what it's done is it's also informed what we see as sort of the long-term monetization model for Stash anyway. You're asking a pretty simple question that gets to a much harder question, which is sure. like, what is the most valuable asset? And for us, the answer is attention and has mm-hmm. always been attention. And sure. the way I explain it is attention is humans times time. Time is finite. Humans are crazy valuable and there's only so many of them and they're very fickle. So attention becomes this super fickle and scarce asset that is the most valuable asset really in the Web 2 world. The difference with Web 3 is not going to be that attention is no longer valuable. The difference is going to be how the consumer and producer surplus breaks down. And we want consumers to take back a share of the surplus that's generated when people who want your attention require it and are willing to pay for the privilege of having it in some way, whether it's monetarily or with some other kind of incentive, they want it. So community canvas is all community moderated, right? If the community wants somebody else's attention and they're willing to put in the time, the gems, whatever, to get another user's attention, it's a tool we give them as a collective to do that. And it requires social coordination because you have to take over the canvas or you take over a single square, but it's community mediated. We don't use that same canvas and say, okay, we sold it to Nike today and now mm-hmm. it's Nike's mm-hmm. canvas. Mm-hmm.
Nike we would could. Have to come in and get the gems to...
Yeah, for that particular product. And if we launched a right. different product on the platform that was like brand of the day, and we mm-hmm. just called it like Stash's sellout of the day, and we have it and it's the banner on the whole product for the whole day, mm-hmm. I'm not opposed to doing it if it keeps the lights on and the users get a share. That's the idea. But before we get to the part where we can sort of democratize ownership of the entire platform, we have to become self-sustaining. And experimenting with things like the community canvas is how we get there. We test, do users want this? Will they use it? The answer for the canvas has been absolutely. But the canvas becomes exponentially more valuable as we add users because it's a networked product. If we go from 1,000 DAU to 100,000 DAU, the value of that canvas grows by more than a factor of 100. and the canvas starts to escape the confines of Stash's social network into the ether, so to speak, of the Twitters and the Reddits. And suddenly there's a broader social relevance off platform, not just on. All of that gets unlocked with enough users. And right now, I like our nice niche, small, engaged community. But in a year, if we're still at the same size, something's gone terribly wrong.
Right.
Sure. Yeah, I think about the attention a lot related to AI, and you know, the sort of obvious take is, you know, content becomes infinitely reproducible and so on and so forth. But one of the things that humans can never, or AI could never take, is the ability for a human to care about you and whatever it is you're doing. And as a human, I think that's something that we uniquely prefer. It's like, as soon as you realize you're talking to a chatbot, like all the feelings go away.
I have something that I don't think we talked about this when we talked before, but when I was wrapping up my grad school education at MIT, I attended a lecture at the Media Lab from Deb Roy, who, I'll tell you his role at the end of this anecdote, what his professional role was, but he was also a lecturer at the Media Lab. And he shows up and he says, I was supposed to talk to you today about, you know, blah, 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 but I actually woke up this morning and decided I wanted to talk about AI. And this was like 2016.
Oh, wow.
And so he's like, he goes through this whole thing. Everybody's like, AI, everybody says AI is going to replace all our jobs. But they say we're protected on a few things because they don't understand emotion. And then he said, well, actually they do. And he said, actually, they're very good at understanding anger and happiness and these sort of expressions, right? The sentiment analysis that AI can, it definitely understands those emotions. It can provoke those emotions. It kind of understands how, and it can sense them. So that's not really protection. If you work in some sort of emotional career, but it relies really on just these basic human emotions, you're not protected like anybody else. And he kind of foresaw the idea that it would be disrupting just art. Generative art can provoke an emotion, totally, like happiness, yeah, or awe or fear or whatever. But he did say there's one thing that AI really doesn't understand, and that is social emotion. Things like pride, shame, motivation, things that only arise as emotional conditions for humans when they're placed into a social context.
Sure.
So he said the last things to get disrupted from a job perspective are going to be things like coach, mentor, priest.
Totally.
Those are like you're saying now. But he gave me that framework of like, these are social emotions. That's why the AI can't do it. But basic emotions, you know, we can't claim anymore AI doesn't deal in that realm. It certainly does. But we are protected by our humanity, by the fact that AI, fundamentally, LLMs are not social creatures. They just predict behavior, even our behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm sure that they can do a good job at predicting like that social sort of emotion. It's just that my ability to care about their prediction changes when I realize that it's not another human.
Are you ready to hear what his day job was?
Yeah. Okay.
Chief scientist at Twitter.
Nice.
So there that's you go. Funny. And this is obviously in the pre-Elon days, right? But Twitter knew very well. Here's an algorithmic feed. Mm-hmm. Right. And we know that Facebook was dragged publicly for manipulating the feed into making users sad. They did that whole like experiment. Like, because you absolutely can do that to people. But once they know it's happening, like you said, that power over us sort of gets lessened. You understand, it is the algorithm. Like you see the threads on the puppet and you start to feel like, okay, I'm still in control here because I see how it works, and I can make this something that is productive for myself. But if you have no control or visibility into that algorithm, if you're not taught about it, if you don't see it, a 5-year-old spending all day on YouTube right now has no idea the ways in which they're being manipulated. And they need to learn that.
You can watch that happen in real time if you have a 5-year-old.
That is, they do. As someone who thinks they're more like algorithm or tech literate than someone else, it is, you can see it sometimes. You'd be like, oh, you shouldn't click that because like then it will know, or like you shouldn't watch this video for like six times in a row, or like
Yeah.
I'm definitely the kind of person too who gets served an ad on Instagram where if I actually am looking for that item at some point, I'll click on it and X out just so it reminds me later. And then I'm thinking back, and then I'm like, later, I'm just like, why didn't I just write it down?
Right.
Why didn't I just make a to-do list? Why am I waiting for to get another ad for the same thing? And I'm like, that's just going to cost them money.
There's something digitally native about that, though, right? Like, you
totally. I mean, there totally is. There totally is.
An accurate way to use the tool.
Is that what we want to be training humans to do? I don't know.
Right.
But it's certainly not going anywhere because this impacts the daily experience of billions of people. And I'm not here to put that out of business overnight. I'm here to create a better alternative, at least.
Totally. Well, one thing that this is a sidebar, but one thing that I've done on Twitter is ritualistically blocked every single account that has ever promoted or advertised a tweet to me. I don't care who it is or what they've done. If it's promoted, I've blocked them. And so at some point I want to do some sort of like art project with my like 1,000+ growing list of blocked
promoted
accounts.
Tweets. Yeah.
This is
yeah.
scary because I was thinking of advertising on Twitter.
Well, truthfully,
I hear the
CPM
is really
me.
Good right now.
Yeah, I the, bet.
It's mostly me doing it out of spite for like what advertising has done to the human experience.
That's fair.
I recently lost my free YouTube premium from some promotion or another. And to see the world of to see the world through these eyes.
Yeah.
Atrocious. Oh my God. Awful. I was like looking up a video to fix my bike and you sit through 10 seconds of fucking blah 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 blah. And then you get to see how to fix your bike. It's
I remember when they got roasted because they put ads before CPR videos.
Yo, that was funny. Yeah.
And it's like
that's hilarious.
It's like we're just gonna run this 30-second pre-roll while grandma chokes.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like,
no thanks.
Well,
no,
how did we get here?
Yeah.
And recipe sites, it's like, it's amazing. It just is it's an affront to the human condition is how I feel. But in any case, it's just me that I think goes out of their way to block these ads, because here's one thing that Twitter does, which I think is hilarious. The button to hit the triple dots to get into that menu of like how to block somebody is really small.
It's tiny.
And the touch target isn't like beyond the little SVG. It's like, usually when you're making a nice button, you want it to be a big touch target. No, this one's specific. So you always miss it. And when you miss it, you click into the tweet. Oh, and now they know. Now they got that information. I hate
that. They got you.
I'm reading it. Yeah, it was bad.
So I'm the only one
who's willing to deal with that.
Back to Stash. The main product then is essentially a social network. There's a feed. Yeah. You see... you have people posting on their feed. I see someone has updated their PFP and it sort of lets me know.
Yeah, we
about
just
that.
Shipped that. PFPs are now verifiable on chain and we don't make you pay $8 a month for the privilege.
Wow. That's novel.
explain some of the other sort of features of Stash, like what, you know, we've talked about the gumball machine, some of these more sort of fun, flashy stuff. Give us the nitty gritty then of the thing.
Well, the nitty gritty is what you already said, right? Products like this should not be overly complex. The reason we had to reboot the core of the platform was because we had too many awesome, weird, tiny, fun things, and there wasn't the cohesion to bring it together. It wasn't easily navigable or discoverable, and we got that feedback from almost every user. At the same time, they were the same users who said, we really love these social features at the core, this idea that we can discover and connect. So we just decided, well, if that's the one thing everybody's coming back for every single day, we're just going to put it at the center of the app. And the reason that's the approach that we take is very much informed by something I learned while I was working at Snapchat. And they asked Evan Spiegel, who is the CEO, and also like in his mid 20s. we're not talking about some kind of genius, but we are talking about somebody who knew one thing and did it. And they asked him, what's the best decision, accidental or otherwise, that you ever made designing the app? Because he's a very design focused guy. You know, he's not a tech guy. He's not a Zuck. He's very design led. He's an LA native, right? And he said, the best decision we ever made designing Snapchat is it opens to the camera. Because every other app that you would be using for social didn't immediately turn you into a creator. It was the feed. you were immediately a consumer. And he understood that the core of Snapchat's product, the thing that kept people coming back, was just, I see something, I have this urge to send it to a friend. I need to capture it, I need to send it, I need to connect. And you could have even just one really good friend on Snapchat. That was enough to keep you coming back to the product. Eventually, it had to become more complex than that because they needed to be a multi-billion-dollar company. But that was always the core to growing their social graph and growing that retention.
Yeah. So I was impressed at how well that worked on me as well. I had like one friend on Snapchat for the longest time and kept me coming back.
It wasn't like he thought about it as like, you know what, the market's missing a camera app. He thought about it as just like, we're making a fun app. But once he realized that was the important thing, he never killed it. And it's the one thing about the product that never has changed, even as it's, you know, they've changed the navigation, they've done all kinds of things. So with Stash, the one thing I think will never change now that we have it is to put the feed at the middle of everything, which is the same decision that a Facebook or a Twitter has made. But it's a feed that gives you much more contextual information about the type of people you're interacting with. Twitter and Facebook, I think still the content is king. For me, it's always going to be that the atomic unit on Stash is the other user. You're going to want to understand them, who they are, what they collect, their social reputation. Like, you're not going to jump to a conclusion without getting some kind of context as to who this person actually is. Stash as a product is not ideally at its core from the moment you land on it. It's not going to seem complex. What I want it to look like is it's the MySpace of NFTs. Everybody has their own little MySpace profile. You've got your top eight things you've collected, or maybe you've also got your top eight followers. Like, take us back to those days, but then also have the feed, because the news feed on Facebook was how it scaled those low intent users who just craved discovery. And as a beachhead market, NFT collectors and creators, they crave discovery. They crave novelty. They want to see what other people are doing, but they do need that curated for them a bit, hopefully by other collectors like them or creators like them. So it's social curation, but otherwise you get into what you were talking about. There's a content glut. The cost of communication is too low, and therefore everything loses meaning. So there's going to be this, there's going to be an evolution on Stash. Like, that feed is always going to be in the middle. Like, that's always the most important part of the product. As we get more content, that content, we're going to move from how do we promote the creation of content to how do we promote the curation of content as a creator, as a collector. How do we push you to curate your identity even better? Not because you're necessarily doing something performative, but because it helps other users understand you and have context for the thoughts, ideas, assets, whatever that you're sharing on the platform. And as that intent shifts, which just comes with growth, you'll see the product change. You'll see the platform have to change and evolve in response to that. But the feed will be at the middle because we're always going to promote discovery. And then it'll just be about, like, what does your profile look like? What does it look like to be an owner, to be a creator, to discover something someone is offering you, to discover something that somebody else has already collected? Those will all get a little tweaked.
Totally.
If we make the product too thick, though, I don't think we're going to retain a single person. I think they're going to go for something even simpler, even easier to use.
Yeah.
That's what we want to be.
Social. Yeah. Very difficult. I like the, this is something I always keep in mind, like a framework regarding social and identity, is like, you can collect something, you can curate something, and you can create something. And those are all different degrees of energy investment and therefore like identity meaningfulness.
That's a framework, by the way, that they use at Spotify as well.
Oh, really?
Because I was a data scientist there for a summer. And I remember they sort of group things into high and low intent users. High intent users means, you know exactly what you're looking for. And for you, it's all about the search bar and that experience. For low intent users, it's all about the discovery features and how you do that. So as Stash gets more content and becomes more about high intent use, because it's a destination and a regular destination, we optimize the search bar. Until then, we optimize the feed.
Yeah. That's actually quite, that makes a lot of sense, that framework. That's pretty
cool. They're pretty smart over there. Spotify has proven all these nine-figure user platforms, they've proven they kind of know what they're doing. And in Web3, when I see everybody topping out at like 5,000 DAU, but they're refusing to learn anything from Web2, I get really angry.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I wonder how many, is it just like the attitude or the willingness to apply previous frameworks that people are just like not interested in? Or is it like the group of people that are building this or don't have that experience? Like,
a lot of this is by devs for devs, and I'm very openly not a dev, or I don't consider myself one anymore. Like, I'm not coding Stash, but that's because we need business leadership, product leadership, everything else that then informs our technical team that's done an amazing job shipping everything that you see on Stash.
That's a good point, though. Like, dev-led development is at least within the ETH ecosystem, very much front and center, given this perspective. I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's but the reason is also that we had DeFi before we had this user ownership model.
Yeah.
And so capital was king, and the user was obfuscated in favor of the account. The account has a lot of ETH. We have to care about the account. We don't necessarily have to care about the person associated with it. And there was always this confusion and tension between, as we said, privacy and anonymity and pseudonymity. And then, like, also, this is multiple billions of dollars. Maybe we should make sure it's not North Korea. And I look at like completely different use cases for the blockchain, right? All about digital ownership and reputation and rights management and things. None of that requires there to be trillions of dollars of value flowing through the system. You just need a provably correct system or state system.
Substrate, totally.
And that is what we already have. So why not then start to use that for what it's good at before we start using it for something it's bad at? And I do think that's why you get a lot of ETH-based applications in particular that are not user-centric. They're very much account-centric or capital-centric. And that's not what we're building. And I think the advantage we have is because we're deliberately building multi-chain, we don't get sucked into that trap of needing to over-optimize for that audience.
Yeah. What's the building a multi-chain app seems like, as a developer, incredibly painful. What's it like as a product person trying to build a multi-chain app? Yeah.
Well, do you remember the big list of problems?
The big list of problems.
My 100 problems on my hypothetical whiteboard where we go in every day and we try to circle the 5 that we're going to do, right?
Cool.
If we went and we said, okay, we're a multi-chain app, and now let's write out all the problems with that. There's so many problems where it's like, okay, are we custodial? Do we need you to be able to like, are we managing wallets for you across all these different accounts?
Right.
Do we have one NFT representation of your identity where we are now managing all your mnemonics in some sort of encrypted state? Or are we just letting you connect wallets and then we're signing for you? Or, and then it's just like, okay, all of these hard questions. Let's start with the easy question. What if we just could read your assets? All we're doing is reading the state of a public by default chain. The only chain that doesn't let you do that is Secret.
It's Secret.
But we started with the ability on platform, really native, works really well, the ability to interact with a private by default chain and understand these assets. We built all that tooling natively and it works. Everything else after that seems trivial when we're just talking about reading, because everyone has access to that information. We're just pulling data straight from the same chain everybody else is. If we want to know what you own, all you have to do is just tell us, this is your wallet, sign it and prove it. We can even mint things to that address because you tell us it's you. But if you want to send it somewhere, interact and do commerce or whatever, now we're getting into the hard part of being a multi-chain app. Until a user tells us that they want Stash to be where they sign things and act as themselves when they're already terrified that the new thing they click on is going to make them lose their ape. Until a user tells us that's their intention coming to Stash, but we do hear from users, they want to have a multi-chain identity where they can easily import things that they own from all. We're not going to prioritize those multi-chain features, these different ecosystems. And then we can say, okay, that's easy enough. We'll create your multi-chain profile. You connect a wallet. We read your information. There's tooling for that. We would love to support more L1s. We'd love to support ordinals. We'd love to support some of these Cosmos chains, and we're working on it. But for a lot of the others, the tooling already exists to make it dead simple. So we're going to support as many as we can so that we can bring in as many of those users as we can. And by telling them we're multi-chain social, somebody coming from BNB and somebody coming from Polygon and ETH or Solana, like, they can all feel like we are an app made for them, made for this use case. Stash can feel like their home regardless of the L1 ecosystem that they've prioritized collecting in.
Totally. Yeah.
So the top here where it says total assets Stash, that's what you're referring to. We have Secret, 300,000 and Ethereum 24,000 and Polygon 58,000. These are these are not, because when I was looking at that, I was imagining, wow, that's a lot of bridged assets. That's a lot of assets that have been bridged somewhere. But it's what you're doing is you're just referring to people who have signed up for the app and come on here, and then they've connected their wallets, and now you see.
And they've imported it into their profile. They've set up some sort of public facing profile, and we verb it, right? Like, you stashed it. That just means you have represented this as part of your outward facing identity. You stashed it. But it's a lot easier to say you stashed it than you internalized this as a portion of your intersectional identity. It doesn't fit in the button. So we do the other thing.
Profile is something that a lot of people have been trying to do as well. Is that something you think about as a core? Yeah. Just like
we have to. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the next thing we need to master. First, we're mastering the feed, but we need to master the profile, because we said the atomic unit on Stash is the user.
I want to make a request, or just in that spirit of MySpace, right?
This
is something we've talked about so much, which is
a song auto-playing when you land on the profile.
Part of that, right? That's part of it. But also the HTML, just the ability to poorly or not, like, deck out your profile to be.
There's got
to
be a blend of customization. Like, you want a framework to work in. You want constraints, but you also want creativity and You know, it's a hard balance, right? Facebook is very much on one end, and MySpace was very much on the, well, writing your own HTML app is on the other, but like something in the middle is probably going to get you most people's interest.
Definitely. So the first thing we added, right, in terms of profiles was PFP verification. Because here's what we can do. When you combine that basic feature with the feed, now what we can do is, let's say you guys are all punks. So you come to the platform, and again, we're not asking you to bridge an asset. We're not asking you to sign anything. You're proving ownership of a wallet holding a punk to Stash. Now Stash allows you, just like Twitter, to set that thing as your PFP. We verify that you are the owner of that thing. If you guys are all on the platform, all using a PFP from the same collection, we can now recommend other users to your social graph who have the same PFP.
Right,
you're coming together and discovering each other on platform. Whether that extends off platform or not, that's up to you. But we can also, we're also, you know, this isn't really alpha because it's inevitable. We're going to add messaging to the platform, right?
Totally.
And it becomes more one-to-one than sort of the feed.
Every app grows until it has a messaging feature, but yes.
Pretty much. Or actually stories.
Yeah, it's actually stories.
Stash stories.
No, I mean, it's a social app. You should have messaging. Totally.
Yeah. But you see the point. It's like you now have this like basic, that's just this little thing about your identity. To set up a profile with your PFP is universal to like every social platform. People understand what that means. We're giving it the highest possible social context and the most relevancy. And we're helping you use that to build your social graph. But it's multi-chain. There's certainly networks that are ETH native that have sort of replicated that feature, right? You know, all these different things that are trying to deliberately be very Web3 social, very decentralized social, on-chain social graphs and everything. We're trying to be multi-chain. So we're solving this problem for Solana and Tezos and everybody else. So because they have communities too, these massive PFP communities, they come in, they set their PFP as those projects. Now they discover each other, but they're also same time discovering all of these ETH projects, and it starts to feed back on itself. It's both a way to curate your community and build these context silos, but also deliberately to break down the walls of those silos with this social feed where we can recommend other users' profiles to you. Let's say their PFP is not your PFP, but they own something from the collection that your PFP is from, we can still recommend that user to you. And now you're like, oh, where's their PFP from? You've discovered a new community that they identify even more strongly with, but you are intersectional with that person. And I'm saying community, but it could also be like you've collected the same artist's work, you know, conceptualize it however you want. But yeah, that's the most important thing about the profile. And that's the thing that we've already shipped, is this PFP functionality. And then everything else around customizability, I would love to have you guys just get in there and be like, tell me how to GeoCities this shit. Like, we will we will make it so fun. MySpace is a very deliberate analogy that I use. We don't want to be Facebook. MySpace is
we've referenced that.
I feel like we've talked about MySpace from the very first episode of this podcast.
Yeah, definitely.
There you go.
I think it was might have been the very first episode.
Nice. Oh, yeah, can you guys get Tom on?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, totally. That'd be lit.
Oh, man.
We think about, social contracts. The JPEG social contracts reminds me of which, ownership and the social network that is people who own the same things as you, and like what that says about how you get along and so on.
Right.
That was a really cool moment. And so like, yeah, that sense of like you have ownership on chain, and that's relevant to identity, yeah. And like tying that into social. So,
it's weighted, right? Certain communities are going to have, like, if you think about scoring it, like certain communities are going to have sort of like a 95% alignment on ethos. Other communities, it's going to be like 10% because it was a hyped mint or something like that. Stash can sort of, what I'm excited to be able to do is sort of infer that from on-chain and off-chain data. It's like, do we infer that ownership from this particular collection is correlated with interest? And we can look at follow rates for users that are like following other people from the same ecosystem, for people who've collected the same things. Chances are, if it's a high intent, high ethos alignment community, there's going to be a very tight knit social graph that organically forms. Then we can infer that this collection has high social value, as opposed to just, this is a thing that minted out and then people tried to double their money and now they're just bag holders. There's enough data to be able to understand one from the other. And that is helpful contextual data to anybody who's trying to then value that collection.
Totally. Yeah, that's really interesting.
But you need the context.
I was going to say, yeah, this is all based on the social layer and adding that context to ownership itself. So that's really exciting. Yeah, I can't wait for a digitally native substrate to be commonplace. That's awesome.
If you're listening to this podcast, you'll soon be able to just immediately come to Stash and sign up with your email. But it's really, it takes like 30 seconds or less to set up an account. And if you already have the wallet, it takes literally 0 seconds. But in the future, yeah, it'll be like email auth. You get in there, you immediately start earning gems. You immediately start using the social feed. Like, we're going to start pushing this pretty ambitiously soon. The goal is to be the first Web3 app with like 100K DAU.
Sure. That's all that matters. I love how that's the bar, right? Is like, yeah.
100K. That's table stakes. That's table stakes for relevance.
That's like, yeah, that's totally. Like, that's like, yeah, bare, that's bare incredible. Minimum. Yeah.
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 Right. Dope. Well, it's been great to have you on. We hit our time. Thank you for coming onto the podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah, Jordan,
this was extremely interesting. And stash.io, it's two H's.
Yep.
Stash.io is the website. And do check it out. Where can we follow you on Twitter? What's your Twitter handle?
It's first name, last name. I'm Tor Bear on Twitter. I'm the only Tor Bear in the universe, so it's pretty easy to find me on pretty much any social platform. I know, except on Stash, I'm This Is Tor. And I'm going to be like
somebody
Tom.
Take your name?
I'm going to be, right?
You'll be everyone's first friend. Yeah.
I want to be everybody's first follow, like Elon on yeah. Twitter, right? It's like, yeah. just to subject say, you yeah. to all of my insane ramblings. Nah, we don't do that to anybody
that's
yet.
Awesome.
But yeah, username never, claiming.
You've never met anyone else named Tor Bear. Tor Bear.
No, and if I did, I'd have to kill him. Highlander.
Yeah. Totally. At this point, you're like,
we're kind of invested in this, you know, one of one mentality.
One of one
so like,
thing.
Yeah,
totally. I would hate to find out that there's a season two of me.
Oh, totally. Yeah,
that would just kill my floor.
Yeah, Matt's were an open mint for like all of the 1990s.
But you can have a. That there's power in numbers, my friend.
There's power. I mean, the Mataverse.
Okay.
There's more than 69. I think there's 70 Mats in the Mataverse Telegram channel. So we're doing quite well.
Beautiful. Well,
I'm friends with like a ton of Jonathan Manns on Facebook.
Oh, you have one of those Jonathan Mann circles. Yeah, anyways, thanks for having me on.
Yeah,
hopefully
totally.
By now users have understood what the Coke Zero.
Oh, for sure.
Day reference.
Yes, totally.
Yeah,
totally. Yes, we'll put that here.
Yeah,
I guess
we'll put the go at the very end, right here. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Perfect.
Cool. Thank you, Tor.
Callbacks are important. All right, thank you guys.
Tor, thank you so much. You. Take it
Cheers.
Easy.
Cool.
You too.
Ciao.
Oh, yeah. You gotta get nifty. It's time to get nifty. We've been hard at work, man. That's all. We shipped V2 yesterday. It's a soft launch.
I was
going to
say, tight.
It.
Oh, damn.
Yeah,
Not till end of June are we going to like make a big deal of it. We don't even want to say V2 because it's like, it feels like this is what the product should have been from inception. So we're just going to be like new Stash, like new Coke, and let people deal with it.
Totally. That'd be kind of cool if soft drinks had versions.
Coke 2.0. Right?
Yeah, like they always replace it in place, right? They're like, you know, this is just new Coke. You know, it's the same, but different.
Yeah,
but like,
yeah,
it'd be cool if they were versions.
Or they killed Sierra Mist and they came up with Starry. Mm-hmm. And then it's, but then you'd have like Coke 2.0.1 and everybody would be like, what was wrong with 2.0? Yeah. I had a lot of that stuff. Why did they have to push the fix? Yeah.
Is that a security fix? What the fuck?
Update your Coke now.
Yeah. There's a fucking Coke OTA. You need to download that right now. This is a
zero day.
This is the Coke 0 day.
Oh, no. God, we got to save this stuff. This is the bonus good. Content, right?
Coke 0 day. That's good.
That's actually my new DJ name. I like
that. That's really good. That's a really good name for like Coke an Anon 0 day. Or like one of those Anon Solidity devs. You've got to be a Zoomer, 16 years old, and your name is Coke 0 day.
Yeah, I'm an MEV extractor.
Yeah, Coke 0 day.eth is MEV. Yeah.
The alpha.